once again to the Blueprints, Canada's conservative podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Schmale, Member of Parliament for Halliburton, Kawartha, Mike Sprock. Thank you once again for joining us today. We have an amazing show, as always, lined up for you. But before we get into the contents, we need you to remember to like, comment, subscribe, share this program. Help us push back against the ever-moving Liberal agenda. But if you can't watch us all today here on Facebook, you can download us on platforms like iTunes, Google Play, CastBox, those types of platforms, and you can listen to us at your leisure. And of course, because we are asking you to reach into your social network, that allows us to get the conservative message out to undecided voters. Maybe an individual that you know that is on the fence about how they're going to vote in the next federal election. We need that assistance from you, the listener, the viewer, that can help educate and inform the everyday Canadian that might not be listening outside the mainstream media. So that's why we ask you to do that. And we appreciate that, because the message coming up from our guest, Michael Chong, the Member of Parliament for Wellington, Halton Hills, he's also the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs, is particularly important because freedom is at stake in this conversation that we're going to talk about. So Michael, thank you very much for coming on the show and joining us.
Great to be here again, Jamie.
And as we mentioned in the opening, the situation going on in Hong Kong specifically has been going on for quite a number of months. It started with a few pieces of legislation that were proposed at one point. One of them that kind of, teed it all off was an extradition bill, which started Hong Kong having agreements with jurisdictions like China, which would allow extraditions to take place. And then those being sent to the mainland would then be at the mercy of Chinese law, which is, as we are seeing in many stories that are coming out, is far more brutal than Hong Kong could ever be. But maybe you want to comment on that, because you have a history with Hong Kong. Your father was born in Hong Kong.
That's right, Jamie. My father was born and raised in Hong Kong and watched as Canadian soldiers bravely defended Hong Kongers during the first combat engagement of the Canadian Army in the Second World War. It was a pretty vicious fight. Some 2,000 Canadians from Winnipeg and Quebec City were sent over, and half of them were casualties. And the ones that survived were taken prisoner of war and lived in horrific conditions for years before they were liberated at the end of the war in 1945. So my father and my family have never forgotten the sacrifices of those Canadian soldiers so long ago. You mentioned the extradition treaty. There's been ongoing issues in Hong Kong for a number of years now. What started off about 7 or 8 years ago with irregular disappearances of booksellers and journalists and other people living in Hong Kong, which one could have dismissed as coincidental, suddenly developed into a much bigger pattern when the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region government introduced an extradition bill that would have allowed anybody in Hong Kong, including Canadian citizens, to be extradited to mainland China, where they do not have the same independent judiciary system as Hong Kong and where there is no rule of law and procedural fairness. So that bill was withdrawn because of the massive protests that took place in Hong Kong last year. But subsequent to that, the mainland government imposed a draconian new national security law on Hong Kong in violation of a national international treaty. That international treaty is the 1984 joint declaration between the government of the People's Republic of China and the United Kingdom. That treaty came into effect in 1997 for a period of 50 years, and it guaranteed Hong Kongers liberties. It guaranteed them freedom of the press, freedom of association, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and a whole range of other freedoms that we enjoy here in Canada. By imposing this draconian national security law, both the Hong Kong and Chinese governments are violating that international treaty. That treaty was registered at the United Nations, and Canada was a witness to that registry. And so we are not just a witness to it, but we have an obligation to uphold these sorts of treaties to ensure that our international system, our rules-based international system, continues to function. So This is a huge concern since this draconian new law was imposed last summer. And we're very concerned about the welfare of the 300,000 Canadians living in Hong Kong.
Now, before we get into the remarks by China's ambassador to Canada that were made just recently, it's important to note, too, that Hong Kong, although it's one country, they have two systems. I guess that's the way it's set up, and it's known around the world as the fact that, as you mentioned, it does have that autonomy.
That's right. The joint declaration agreed to in 1984 that came into effect at handover in 1997 on July 1st guaranteed one country, two systems, one system for mainland China with the People's Republic of China government based in Beijing, and a second independent system for the Special Administrative Region government in Hong Kong. And so in practical terms, what that meant was that Hong Kong, for example, has separate representation at some international body, separate from the mainland Chinese government, at the WTO and at other international organizations. It also means, for example, that Hong Kongers can come to Canada without requiring a visa, but mainland Chinese visitors need a visa. It means that people from mainland China cannot go into Hong Kong without passing through border control and without obtaining a visa. It means that, for example, Hong Kong does not use the Chinese currency. It has a separate currency, the Hong Kong dollar, which is effectively the U.S. dollar because it's pegged to the U.S. dollar. It has its own monetary policy, its own court system. In effect, it has the liberties, the rule of law, and some democracy that we have here in Canada. And the 50-year Sino-British agreement was supposed to protect that. This draconian new national security law imposed last summer does away with that and is in violation of that international treaty.
And as these protesters fill the streets like they've had for months and months trying to protect their freedoms, the Chinese ambassador in Canada made a very, very controversial remark. Basically, I would say, you may disagree, almost to the point of threatening Canada not to grant asylum to some of the people that are trying to flee Hong Kong because of the overreaches being made by mainland China.
Yeah, it was a very clumsy remark. It's part of a broader pattern of what many people have called the wolf diplomacy of Chinese ambassadors and consul generals abroad. I think it's backfiring on the Chinese. And the evidence is this, that the Pew Center for Research, it's an American-based organization that has done many decades of research and polling in advanced economies on people's opinions of China, has shown in the last several years that the public's opinion of China, not just here in Canada, but in the United States and Europe, has plummeted. The view of citizens living in many countries around the world has plummeted. Many people don't trust China. They view it increasingly as a malevolent force in the world. And so, what's so confounding about this wolf warrior diplomacy is that it is not working for the Chinese. And I think these comments the ambassador recently made about the 300,000 citizens living in Hong Kong is part of that broader pattern that simply isn't working for them. So, my view is that at some point the Chinese government needs to see this and realize that their approach of the last several years is actually working against their own very interests. The other thing that I think needs to be known is that, the Chinese the Chinese position is that it's none of anybody's business about what goes in Hong Kong. And I and many other of our allies completely disagree, and they're wrong on this. And they're wrong for the following reason. China is party to international treaties, international organizations. When a country enters into a treaty, it gives up some of its sovereignty. When a country gives, for example, negotiates a free trade agreement, it gives up some sovereignty over the control of an export and import of goods into their own country. When a country signs a treaty on human rights and freedoms, they give up some sovereignty and agree to abide by the terms of that treaty. That's the first reason why countries outside of China have the right to comment on events going on in Hong Kong. We have an obligation as Canadians, as do other allies, to ensure that the international rules-based order is upheld when we see a country like China violating that treaty. The second reason is quite simple. We have 300,000 citizens living there, and we have every right to defend their interests.
Canada has had a very strained relationship with China over the past few years. We have the situation with the Huawei executive being held in Canada until the court process goes forward. We have the two Michaels being held over in mainland China. We have, at one point, China holding off exports of such things as pork and other products, hurting our agriculture sector. We have, of course, COVID-19, where information coming out of China about the lethal nature of it and a lot of the protective measures seem to be basically all false information or brushing it off, given to the World Health Organization, which then caused governments to adapt their responses accordingly based on that false information. And so How do you see at what point does kind of the world get together and say enough is enough here? Because as you mentioned, there are treaties that we do expect some peace, of course, in the world. But when you have a kind of a communist style government that doesn't really, based on what I'm seeing, doesn't really care about its people. The people at the end of the day, the Chinese people do suffer as a result.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie. I think things have changed tremendously in the last several years. You know, one of the assumptions that we based our policy on China, and by we, I mean Western democracies, for the last 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, was this principle that authoritarian states like China, like Russia, could be brought into the international system and could improve their human rights records, their records on the rule of law, by more closely engaging with them on trade and on investment. And so the thinking was 30 years ago that, you know, we had won the Cold War as Western democracies, and that by more closely trading and investing with each other, with authoritarian regimes like China and Russia, that we would gradually bring them into this international system where they would gradually improve their human rights records, their records on justice and the like. Well, that assumption has been proven wrong in the last several years. And I think democracies, our allies, are now coming to realize this and are revisiting that assumption and pivoting to a very different approach on China. And for example, if you look at an ally like Germany, Germany has recently labeled China a strategic rival. They've also put in place new policies to review the takeover by Chinese state-owned enterprises of German companies, and they've taken a number of other measures. Canada needs to do the same thing. The problem with the Canadian government's approach to China is that they have yet to do that. They have acknowledged that their China policy is broken. They've been telling us for the last year that they're going to come forward with a new China framework. We've yet to see it. We're waiting for it to come to be released publicly sometime this fall. But I'm not optimistic that that will solve the problem, because regardless of what the policy is, this government has proven time and time again to be completely inconsistent and incoherent on its China policy. Just several examples I can point out. You know, it was just last year in January of 2019, just weeks after the two Michaels, Michael Kobrick and Michael Spavor, had been wrongfully kidnapped and detained by China, but the Prime Minister said that the government of Canada wasn't in any way, shape, or form going to consider any proposal to either interfere with the judicial proceedings with Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver, nor were they willing to consider doing a swap of the two Michaels for Meng Wanzhou. The same weekend, the Ambassador McCallum, tells the media on two separate occasions that we should consider doing that. He was subsequently fired for that offense. This past summer, we have the foreign minister telling the House of Commons that they are considering sanctions on Chinese officials for their conduct in Hong Kong. And then the very next day, the government tells Reuters that that's off the table. Several weeks ago, we have the foreign minister telling the Globe and Mail that the pursuit of free trade talks is off, that the government's no longer going to pursue free trade talks with China. On the same day, Canadian Ambassador to China Dominic Barton tells a crowd in Edmonton, including the Chinese ambassador to Canada, that Canada needs to be in China, needs to do more in China, and needs to broaden trade with China. I mean, they can't get their story straight. And so I'm not optimistic that this new framework is going to address that problem.
So our new leader, Aaron O'Toole, has come up with a few ideas, and so have you on your comments in the media. How would you be handling this differently if you were foreign affairs minister and Aaron O'Toole was prime minister?
Well, number one, and most importantly, is to speak with a clear, consistent, coherent voice so that we can get our message across, not just to China, but also to our allies. You know, one of the questions I had today with on a discussion I had with some of the diplomatic corps here in Ottawa was, do you think our allies could have done more to help out Canada with respect to the two Michaels who the Chinese have kidnapped and detained? And my answer is no. Like, how are our allies supposed to know what our position is when, you know, the ambassador to Canadian ambassador to China says one thing and the prime minister says another? When, you know, the foreign minister says one thing and you know, the next day the government says something else, or when, you know, the foreign minister says one thing on trade and the Canadian ambassador to China says something else. We've got to have a consistent, coherent, clear voice in order to be effective in foreign policy.
I think that, do you think it goes also to the fact when we lost our bid for the UN Security Council seat under Justin Trudeau, which we got less votes this time than we did under Stephen Harper? Do you think that's the overall picture with the global community and how they view Canada, that under Justin Trudeau's leadership, the Canada's role and place in the international community has been diminished? Because as you mentioned, the government itself doesn't seem to know where they're going and how to get there.
I think that's exactly it. I've heard that from Canadian foreign policy experts. I've also heard that from our allies abroad, that there's far too much rhetoric coming from Canada and not enough action. You cannot take a virtue signaling stand on the global stage if you're not going to have any hard power to back it up. You know, the prime minister's prime minister's first forays on the global stage were a disaster, and they did Canada's image much harm. For example, his 8-day trip to India turned out to be a complete unmitigated disaster and pretty much sidelined any chance we had of strengthening bilateral relations with the world's largest democracy or including free trade. You know, his antics at the first Trans-Pacific Partnership meeting, where the heads of 10 governments were about to sign the agreement, and he was a no-show, also did damage to our relationship. And when the government of Canada decided to explore free trade talks with China, you know, the government once again put rhetoric ahead of reality when they introduced at the very first exploratory talks their progressive agenda on gender rights, labor, and the environment, a complete non-starter for the Chinese. I mean, that deal, those talks were dead before they even began. So, you know, we need to cut out the rhetoric unless we're willing to back it up with action and hard action.
And that's why we're using platforms like this, as you know, Michael, to try to get out the other side of the story, because I think you know as well as I do, if Stephen Harper or Aaron O'Toole did anything like that, didn't show up for a major meeting with the TPP leaders, the media would just throw themselves on the floor and lose their collective minds. Whereas right now, Justin Trudeau seems to get, in my opinion, a free pass pretty much every single time, or it's talked about for a day or two. The media went on for weeks and months about Stephen Harper losing the UN Security Council seat. The media talked it away in a couple of days under Trudeau.
Well, there's a lot of qualitative assessment of the effectiveness of a government's foreign policy. That was true now. It was true when conservatives were in government. But from time to time, there is quantitative evidence of a government's foreign policy. And the quantitative evidence on this particular government is damning. There's three hard quantitative facts that we can point to demonstrate that this government's record has taken Canada, has diminished Canada's position on the global stage. Number one, which is one you've mentioned, is that last June, there was a vote by the members of the United Nations for the UN Security Council seat for which Canada was running. Canada won 108 votes last June. That's six fewer votes than Canada won a decade ago. That's six fewer countries on the global stage that see Canada as a leader. That is a quantitative indictment of this government's foreign policy. The second example is on overseas development assistance, on foreign aid. Over the 10 years of the previous conservative government, foreign aid averaged 0.3% of our economy. Under this government, it has averaged 0.27%. That is a 10% decline in foreign aid under the current Liberal government. Again, a quantifiable, undeniable indictment of this government's foreign aid program. And third, they came to office with a lot of hullabaloo about climate change. They said they were going to do much better than the previous government and that the Harper targets for 2030 were not good enough. Well, the first thing they did was they adopted the Harper targets in the Paris Accord. The second thing they did is they came forward a plan that is actually not reducing our emissions. The fact of the matter is, the first full year they were in power, Canada's emissions in 2016 were 708 megatons. In 2018, the last year for which the government has released data, which they released in April in the middle of the pandemic, in 2018, three full years into the life of the current Liberal government, emissions rose from 708 megatons to 729 megatons. That is a 21 megaton increase in emissions. Canada's emissions under this Liberal government are increasing, not decreasing, taking us ever further away from the Paris Accord targets of 2030. So three quantifiable, undeniable indictments of this government's foreign policy. And so those are things we can point to tell Canadians that this government's foreign policy simply isn't working.
Michael Chong, I don't know a better way to end it. Unfortunately, question period is coming out. I need to get out of the way. You ended that perfectly, but I do have to ask, I always give the floor to our guest. Anything else you'd like to say? I don't know how you can top that, but I give you the floor.
Just to say that it's great to be on with you, Jamie, once again. And I know the good folks in Halliburton must be enjoying the last dying days of the leaves, the beautiful colors up in your region of the country like we are in southwestern Ontario.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Michael Chong, the Member of Parliament for Wellington, Halton Hills, just outside of the Greater Toronto area. For those of you watching outside Ontario, he's also the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs. We appreciate his time. It's a massive file, but lots of information. We'll have him on again because there is much more to talk about. And please remember, like, comment, subscribe, share this program, help us push back against the ever-moving Liberal agenda. And of course, if you can't watch it, the whole thing right this second or today, you can download it, listen to it while you're doing other tasks on Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, CastBox, you name it, it's out there. Thank you very much for joining us. We will have more new episodes for you next Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope to see you next week. And of course, remember, as always, low taxes, less governments, more freedom. That's the blueprints. Thanks for joining us.